Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Coming to you live from Hollywood, it's Rated G Radio with your host, Garrett Miller.
Hey everybody, welcome to the show. It is Monday night, and we have got a fantastic show for you tonight. We've got Michael Vaccaro. He is the star of Child of the 70s. They're beginning a third season on the web. You can see the first two seasons now if you go to YouTube and look for Child of the 70s, or also go to the website. What you're going to hear tonight is an experiment that we're doing live for the first time, and that is a pre-recorded interview. I met Michael a couple of weeks ago, and we sat down and had lunch over, And then during lunch, before and during and after, we did our interview. So you're going to hear part one, and we're going to then play the theme song for Michael's show, Child of the 70s, which is really fun, and then go into part two and talk about so much more and play some music that Michael recorded a few years ago. And that is going to be our show for today. So I'm going to have you sit back, relax, and enjoy this fun interview with Michael Vaccaro.
Okay, I think we're recording. So today on the show, we're welcoming Michael Vaccaro. He's the star of Child of the 70s, available on the web today. There's two seasons out. He's getting ready to film season three. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
And for everybody listening, we're doing kind of an experiment today. We're actually doing this pre-recorded live at the Continental Kitchen in West Hollywood today. So you'll hear some background noise and some people eating their food loudly and enjoying it.
And we will be eating. I will be eating.
We're going to be eating as well.
This is like breakfast for me. I will be eating throughout this entire... I'm Italian, so I eat all day long.
So the last time we met you,
yes,
you had breakfast at the same time as well. So what time do you go to bed and what time do you get up?
Gosh, well, that would entail me actually having some sleep.
Oh, okay.
So meaning waking up means that I've actually been asleep, because I don't sleep a whole lot. I don't get a lot of sleep. But to answer your question, I probably end up passing out around 4 or 5 in the morning.
Wow.
And, get up around 10.
Okay.
I'm guessing, something like that. Yeah, yeah.
So this really is your breakfast time.
So yeah, so, and also it's hard for me. I'm not one of those people who can eat breakfast. Like, I don't like just get out of bed. I don't know how human beings do it. Get out of bed and just like eat.
I don't
first
either.
Thing in the morning, I can't do it. I can have coffee, and when I smoke, I can have a cigarette,
yep.
And I could possibly have some water,
yep,
with lemon.
Yeah, water with
but,
lemon,
which
thing
is my new big thing. But yeah, I can't eat. It takes me a few hours to actually be able to eat something.
I'm not when I get up, and I'm usually up by like 6 or something like that, because you know the dogs want to get up and they're running around. I can do coffee, or I can do, you know, lemon water, something like that as well, but I can't eat anything first thing. My system just is like, this is not a good thing.
So if you're waking up at 6, what time do you go to bed?
Probably by the time the show's over and I get guests booked and everything else that I've got going on, I try to get to bed by like 11, and then, you know, I will put on like Portlandia or something on Netflix just to have honest background noise while I just kind of...
That is amazing. I mean, I think it's because, you know, I'm from New York City,
yeah,
and I was in the theater for many, many, many years in New York, and so you don't get out of work until 11,
yeah,
you know, 10:30, 11 o'clock, something like that. So, and then you go out to dinner.
Right.
And so, okay. I mean, honestly, still to this day, many, many, many years later, dinner time for me is around 11 or 12 at night.
Yeah.
I mean, that's when I go out and eat dinner. So, yeah.
I can't imagine eating dinner at 11 o'clock at night. That would just, like, that would fry my system. But, I mean, I would love to eat at 11 o'clock at night. I just, you know, okay, I can't do this anymore, so... Yeah, so it was funny because as we're sitting here getting ready to order our meal today, Michael's sitting here going, I've got this new thing that I'm doing. I'm drinking lemon water. I'm like, holy cow, I drink lemon water too. So we've been kind of going back and forth on why we do that.
Well, apparently it's the thing that's going to cure us all. Seriously, all these things that I read, lemon water, first thing in the morning, like a big glass of lemon water, first thing in the morning, you won't get cancer.
Yeah, it has to do with the alkalinity and the acidity.
Right. The other thing, too, that I'm hooked on, avocados. Avocados, eat at least one avocado every single day. So that's 365 avocados a year.
Yeah.
And I guess it's tough because avocados are expensive. But, I just read this whole thing, you know, I mean, who knows, people are crazy. But this woman, I read this article about her, and she said that she cured herself of breast cancer by eating nothing but avocados. Like, literally, that's what she just stopped eating regular food and just ate avocados. But everything that I've read about it, it's like the superfood. Avocados and turmeric. Are you into turmeric?
Now, I told you that for dinner I eat glop, right?
I don't think you did tell
me
that. Explain to your listeners what glop is.
Glop is, this. Number one, it's a fun word to say, so that's really why I call it glop.
Well, see, as soon as you say it, I think of pink slime.
You could make
pink
slime.
You know.
I'll bring you some glop sometime, and I'll make you eat it, and you'll be like, I like glop.
Okay, all right.
I'll get you to convert, but... I've gone on a vacation to Mexico a couple of years ago with my folks, and one of the big things my parents always did is, you know, they'd be in the room and they would cook dinner instead of going out to eat. So I went over on one of the nights, and Karen made fajitas. And I've always hated fajitas. I thought they were disgusting and gross. I hate the smell of it when they come out to the restaurant and put it in front of you. And her fajitas were the best thing I've ever eaten in my life. And so I came home and I said, I need to kind of like get on a fajita bandwagon here. So I started making the fajitas, and I realized I really liked it, but there was just something about it that wasn't clicking with me the way I did it. Now, if Karen was able to come over here to California and make fajitas 27 days a week, that would be great, but she's not. So I took the ingredients, onions, bell pepper, tomato, but I threw in some carrots, and I just sauteed them all with a little fajita mix,
mm-hmm.
and at the end of that, I put it into my Vitamix and puree it.
Oh.
But in that, I put in chia seeds, red pepper flakes, cayenne pepper, and tons of turmeric, and I blend that all up. So it becomes really like a soup.
Wow.
And
okay.
So I take the soup and make it batch for a week, and it sits in the refrigerator. So every night I come home and I dice up the squash, pour the lop, is what I call the fajita soup,
on top of that, and then
heat it up, and that's my dinner. So
gotcha, wow.
I eat glop 7 nights a week for dinner, and I love it. And people think I've lost my mind, but it's like if I wanted something else, I would do it. And if you try it once, you're like,
all right. And now, I mean, and now we know what to give you when you're old and you don't have teeth.
Right, glop. Glop is the best. So what has kept you on this lemon water kick?
I just happened to read about it. I don't know how what I read, but I read something about it, and then I was like, okay, fine, whatever. We're all supposed to drink more water, whatever. And then I think maybe even the same day I happened to read something else about it, and then like over a week, about a week, I kept reading like literally all this stuff, and I thought, okay, well, somebody's trying to get me to drink water with lemon. Water in LA is so disgusting.
Yeah.
I'm from New York, and New York has like amazing tap water.
Really?
New York has like the most delicious tap water.
Is that why the pizza's so good there?
Maybe.
Okay.
But tap water in New York is absolutely fantastic. And I was just there for the month of December, and so coming back here, like you can't drink the water,
no.
You can't do it. And so I have to get bottled water. You know, it's one of those things. I kind of hate drinking water. I kind of hate it.
Really?
Yeah. And so putting the lemon in it actually helps.
You look like somebody who would love to drink water.
Yeah, well, again, it's all smoke and mirrors. It's all facade. It's all lighting. So now with the lemon, sometimes I use lime as well. I will drink water all day long. So maybe, yes, maybe that's why I'm...
You're glowing.
I'm glowing.
You have a glow.
You all can't see it, but I'm glowing.
Yeah. Well, and it's not radioactive glowing either.
Right.
So, yeah. So, now, one of the other... I thought really when you were going to tell me about the lemon water is because you've got a new role coming up. But can you talk about it yet, or is it something that...
I believe I can talk about it.
Okay.
I have to get into, like, super ripped shape. I have to lose about 10 pounds, and we just have to get, like, shredded. Can I have a cappuccino? Thank you. That looks delicious.
I see. Thank you.
It's actually a pilot based on a book. It's a fantasy series called Coven of Wolves.
Wow.
And it's I'm very excited about it because it's about a coven.
Okay.
There we go.
Who's?
Yes, that's me.
Who's your dress?
And I'm the bad guy.
Are you the bad guy?
Yeah.
No one's bad here.
Okay.
There's always tomorrow. There's always tomorrow.
If you can't be good, be good at it.
There we go.
All right. So I was saying that it's a series of fantasy books called Coven of Wolves, and it is about a coven because they're also witches. They're witches and wolves. They're witches who can turn into wolves, and they're all gay.
Wow.
Right. And so I'm very excited about it, and we're going to start shooting a pilot. next month. So I have to look like a werewolf.
Yeah. Okay.
So I have to shred a little bit.
You gotta turn into Hugh Jackman a little bit.
I have to do a little bit of a Hugh Jackman thing. That's right. Which is fun. Which I'm really excited about it. I'm looking forward to it.
But I think that one of the interesting things about you, Michael, is that you have so many different things that you've done over the course of your career. Now, you started out your career in cinema with somebody that I think a lot of the listeners would recognize, at least as far as their name goes.
Yeah.
And can you tell us about your movie experience?
Well, which movie experience are you referring to? Because there are many.
Might be the Sarah Jessica Parker.
Oh, well, I mean, I grew up in New York City, and I started working when I was a kid. And so I think I got my first job when I was about 8 years old. I did a lot of work in the theater, and I did a lot of musicals, and I did a lot of regional theater around the country, and a lot of summer stock. Every year I did summer stock. But Sarah Jessica Parker was one of those people who I used to see all the time. We're around the same age. She might be 1 or 2 years younger than me. I'm not sure. But
she's 27.
She's crammed a lot into those 27 years. But yeah, she's somebody who I used to see all the time at auditions and stuff like that. And then, of course, she got into Annie on Broadway. But we're in a film together. The first film I ever did was Rich Kids. It was a really kind of a beautiful film, a Robert Altman film that people don't ever remember for some reason. And she's in it, and I'm in it. Although we didn't shoot anything together. But that was the first film I did, and I want to say that was 1978,
okay,
something like that. Maybe earlier than that, I can't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you grew up in New York. What was that experience like as somebody who's only been there once or twice just to visit?
I find
it very exciting, but I'm not sure. To me, it's just like very loud, and it's always on.
It is loud, and it's always on. I think, you know, the great thing about New York, I don't live there. But I love New York, and I will always be a New Yorker, and I think that New York is sort of the center of the universe. I think, really, New York is just the center of the universe. And and I think everybody, especially in the United States, everybody should go there at least once.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, New York is not like the rest of the United States. But I also think growing up in New York, especially being an actor in New York, I feel like it gives me a distinct advantage in life. I feel like I can go anywhere in the world, and I can navigate wherever I am. Meaning, New York gave me literally a sense of direction and a sense of who I am as a person. Gave me self confidence. You are forced in New York every single day to get from point A to point B without dying. Going through 8 million people, and you have to do it fast, you know, and you have to be goal oriented in New York, and that just really helped me throughout life. I feel like anywhere I take that with me. I can figure things out. I'm street savvy, I guess is the way to put it. I have street sense.
I guess
that's what I'm trying to say. You get that when you grow up in New York. If I had kids, I would absolutely move back. I wouldn't want to raise a child anywhere else in New York City.
Now, because you grew up 27 years ago in New York, how do you think the city's changed from, I mean, for better or for worse,
right,
you know, in
well,
that time period?
Well, I mean, the better or worse depends on, it's all perspective, but, I mean, for me, I grew up in the 60s and 70s in New York City. And it was dirty, and it was gritty, and it was everybody was poverty stricken, and it's obviously not the New York that it is today. And I miss it. I miss that grittiness. I miss that thing that New York is known for, which now it's, you know, everybody says this now. New York is sort of Disneyland, but but back in the day, it was a raw, interesting place. Now I think it's certainly a fun place. But it's lost a lot of that, you know. The 70s, that's where, you know, we're talking about this, and I came up in the 70s. The cinema in the 70s had like a real grittiness, a real rawness to it. They shot films differently. A friend of mine just said to me fairly recently, like, Every time he sees a movie from the 70s, he wants to, on his television, he wants to go like Windex with his television screen, because it's all dirty. It's shot dirty. It's all like, you know, and that's what life was like then. And nothing will ever be the same or as great as far as I'm concerned, as that decade, the 70s, was in New York City. You know how like every decade sort of has its city? You know, like the 60s it was San Francisco, and the 70s I think it was New York, and the 80s was Los Angeles, and the 90s was Seattle or whatever. New York will never be the same as it was in the 1970s. It's still the greatest place in the world, but it's different.
It's different.
You know, Times Square, you know, and I really enjoyed that Times Square from those days. I enjoyed the hookers, and I enjoyed the pimps, and I enjoyed the drug addicts, you know, and all that, and the sex clubs, and the, you know, the strippers and all that stuff.
Okay, so not to be stereotypical.
Now all that stuff is gone.
Did the hookers and pimps really look like the hookers and pimps they had on TV?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Get out.
Absolutely. I still have pictures, like, of myself. I looked like a hustler back in the 70s, and I was young. I was a kid. But I was street smart. My mother was a single mother, and she was very independent, and she let me be very independent. And you know, it's not like it is today. Like back then, you used to just, as a kid, you used to just get on the subway and you used to just go places by yourself. And so I did, and I hung out in Times Square and Hell's Kitchen all the time. I mean, and of course, that's where theater was.
Yeah.
And I used to go to the theater by myself all the time.
Wow.
When I was a kid. And I knew actors, and that's where they, you know, that's where they hung out.
So, what would you go see as a kid going to the theater?
Well, I mean, I saw everything. I mean, everything on Broadway from, like, 1968 to 1980. I saw probably everything that was on Broadway.
Mm.
And again, like the movies, it was the best decade for theater. Bob Fosse, you know, Chicago and Pippin and Dreamgirls and Nine, the musical, and, like, all of that stuff, Chita Rivera and Gwen Verdon and Liza Minnelli, those, you know, those are people who, like, it's just different now. Now it's all just revivals and Disney.
Revivals and Disney, yeah.
Revivals and Disney, yeah. I mean, that's basically what it is now. But back then it was, again, that raw thing, that gritty thing.
Do you remember what you paid for a ticket back then?
Yes, I do. Tickets were probably about $5 or $7.
Oh my gosh.
I remember this very, very distinctly. There was a show, I want to say in 1976 or 77, called The Act, directed by Martin Scorsese, and starring Liza Minnelli. Music and lyrics by Kander and Ebb. And it was a scandal because she was charging $25 for a ticket.
Okay.
I saw that show probably about 16 times. But yeah, I remember when the price went up, like everybody was losing their minds. I'm not going to pay $25 to see a show. You know, and now it's, you know, now you have to pay $300 for some total junk. But
did you go see any theater when you're back for Christmas or
I didn't.
Holidays?
I'm so out of the loop. I just didn't have. I was so busy. I didn't have any time. But I know that there are things that I would like to see.
Cool. Let's pause this for a little bit. We'll be.
Tell me, what would you say if I flashed a piece on your way? Tell me, how would you react? If I wore bell-bottom slacks, do you remember a time when bad hair wasn't a crime and most things only cost like a dime? And it seemed that we were dancing all the time. Raise our glass.
Back with Michael Vaccaro, and we just heard the season 3 theme song for his show Child of the 70s. So Michael, let's talk TV here.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so how, before, well, I say let's talk TV and I go, let's go back. So how did you end up out in LA, and what was your genesis out here?
Well, I came out here because I didn't want winter anymore.
Okay.
No more winter from New York City, no more winter. But no, I actually came out here for work. I came out here to do a film. And I was here for about 3 or 4 months, and I just decided to stay. It's just too beautiful out here, and there's also too much work out here. So,
well, as an actor,
yes,
you know,
right, yeah. So I just ended up, I work a lot more here than I do in New York.
Yeah.
I do miss New York actually, but yeah, I live here because of work. I want to. I mean, but it's also, it's gorgeous. I feel like every day I live in paradise.
Well, 74 today.
I mean, I sit by the pool.
Yeah.
It's January. I sit by my pool. You know, I mean, they're literally today having a blizzard, like the worst blizzard in New York City, and I'm gonna go and sit, work on my tan.
Get a little tan this afternoon.
Right. Right. Yeah.
You know, get some color in the skin.
Right.
So you've got this web series that's out there that's just taken the world by storm. It's called Child of the 70s, and you've got 2 seasons under your belt, and you're starting season 3. So tell us about this series, and why did you decide to do this particular project?
Well, let's see. I've had this in my head for a really long time, and I always wanted to go to a network and pitch it. But then all of a sudden, web series came around. And, all the technology changed. So you can have your own camera and you can have your own sound equipment and you can go out and do anything you want. And so once that sort of hit me, that realization hit me, I was like, oh, I could take this idea and actually do it. So I sat down and I wrote it, and it just sort of turned itself into a web series. Again, it's this idea that I've had sort of for a long time, for years and years. And it's sort of a mix between my life and Rhoda.
That's Rhoda. A good cross. Yeah.
my life and Rhoda. Rhoda was my favorite show growing up, and so I always had this idea that I wanted to sort of do like a gay version of Rhoda, as if Rhoda wasn't gay enough.
Right.
So that's how, that was sort of the genesis of it. That was sort of the seed of it in my head. And it sort of turned into a web series. And again, like I said, I wrote it, and then it kind of just took off and had kind of a life of its own. It sort of ended up shooting itself, basically.
So in season 1, what happens that where do we find your character Carlo?
I play this guy named Carlo. Carlo Perdente is his name. And what's funny about that is I don't know if anybody really gets it, but Carlo is a total loser in life. He's just about to turn 40. He's an actor. He's an unsuccessful actor. He's a struggling actor. He's got a rent-controlled apartment in New York City. He's got a boyfriend who's cheating on him. He's got a survival job at a phone sex company. Total loser in life. Perdente, the word perdente in Italian happens to mean loser. And he's got an overbearing Italian family from the Bronx, just like I did, do, whatever. I'm from the Bronx, an Italian family, and constantly being, being yelled at by my family, my mother specifically, to you know, give up this idea of being an actor, you know, get serious about your life, blah, blah, blah. And so that's essentially where we find him when the series begins. He has this really just messed up life, and he's struggling. He's 40 years old and struggling, and just has to figure out how to be an adult, I guess. And then there's this sort of chance encounter with his TV idol from the 70s. Growing up, his favorite show was a show called Mama's Jewels, a show starring a woman named Kiki Lawrence. Of course, all this is fictional.
All of this is fictional, yes.
And there's a chance encounter with this woman. This sort of changes his life forever, changes the trajectory of his life. And so that's essentially the first season right there, what I've just told you.
Okay, yeah. And so your life changes dramatically,
yes,
starting in season two. As far as season two goes, what I find hysterical and funny is your opening in season one,
yes,
and then you have a different opening in season,
yes,
two.
Yes.
You also have some other things that take place in season one and season two,
yes,
as well. So I think there's a lot of charm in that, because it's one of those things that you, if you just get into the series and you're not really paying attention, this is a hard series not to pay attention to, because there's so many things that are just kind of engaging and just capture you.
Well, thanks.
But you go from a completely different life in New York,
right,
to a different life in season two.
Yes.
What's that like?
Well, again, I like, when I wrote it, I thought, well, okay, since there's this sort of major life change happening for him, we have to change everything too. So we changed directors, we changed crew, so it has a completely different look, it has a completely different feel, and I found that to be like really interesting. Like you said, we have a brand new opening. Season three, by the way, will be the same. We also have a brand new director, brand new crew, brand new opening, brand new storyline. I love American Horror Story, this anthology series, and every season is completely different story, completely different characters, whatever. Mine is not as severe as that, but I like the idea that every season is a very individual thing. So yes, yeah, so in season two we move to Los Angeles. And he gets a whole new, there's a whole new cast, a whole new group of people in his life, brand new roommates. He meets all these celebrities in Los Angeles, meets a boyfriend. This is where the Rhoda story comes in. If I'm Rhoda, then I come to Los Angeles and I meet my Joe,
mm-hmm,
his name is actually Joe. And so that takes up a lot of season two, the romance.
Yep.
That love story happens in season two, and then of course there's a big cliffhanger in season two.
Okay, so that is the one thing that I really loved. Well, really, but season one, and I think it set it up for what you're doing in season two, is you have these cliffhangers,
yes,
that you don't have in sitcoms.
Right.
At least I haven't seen it since like Friends.
Right.
You know,
okay,
when,
yes,
you know, does Ross walk out of Rachel's room, or you know, which room does it go?
Yeah.
And you have that exact cliffhanger. It was like watching an episode of Dynasty or something like that.
That's right.
No, we can't have 6 more months or 9 more months before we get to season three.
Correct. Well, that's what I mean. I like it because I grew up on Dynasty and Dallas and all,
yeah,
those things. And
yeah.
So yeah, you want that stuff for sure. The best. I mean, one of the best things ever on television was the Who Shot JR ending. But then the next year, I don't know if you remember this. The next year. 1 year later, exactly, they had a cliffhanger where somebody else gets shot,
mm-hmm,
and there's a dead body lying in the pool, and we don't find out who that dead body is until, you know, the following
season.
September, whatever,
yeah,
it was, and it was Mary Crosby,
right,
the actress who had actually shot JR the year before. It was just so brilliant. I thought, oh my God, yeah.
Good.
And I love things like that. I love when people get shot. so we might have something like that in my show coming up. We do have some Dynasty-esque things coming up in season three. But
I love that.
Yeah.
I love. So okay. So getting out of the show for just a real quick second,
right,
and talking,
yes,
to you as the writer, and,
yes,
and what are all of your roles? Because you're an actor and a writer. You're a producer.
I'm producing the show. I directed a couple of episodes. I wrote it, created. I'm co-writing it. I have a writing partner who I work with. His name is Terrence Moss. And I cater it sometimes.
Okay.
And I find the locations, you know. Yeah, all kinds of stuff.
So you do it all.
Yeah.
So as somebody who has spent much of their career playing parts where, you know, and I don't minimize this in any way, shape, or form, but, you know, you're an actor and you're hired, you just kind of like show up and do your job.
Correct.
So you've taken the show up and do your job, which is hard enough in itself,
right,
and saying,
I'd like to add to that.
Right.
Okay, let me direct it and produce it and write it and scene look, you know, get the scenes all set up and cater it and do. What was going through your head? Because that is a huge...
Well, I mean, honestly, nothing was going through my head, obviously.
Okay.
I mean, like, because I'm a complete idiot, apparently. It was just one of those things where you just have to... I recommend this to everybody. I just sort of jumped in. I had written this thing, and I... Once it was written, I thought I had to do something with it. I really just couldn't let it sit in a drawer. And so I knew nothing about producing. I knew nothing about finances or budgets or raising money or call sheets or any of that. And but I thought, okay, well, let's try it. And you just sort of take it a step at a time and you kind of figure things out. And then you figure more stuff out. And then people want to, then you start to have something, and then you bring in people, and then they bring in people, and before I knew it, it was actually kind of sad, it was actually no longer mine. I remember when it happened, we were shooting the very last shot, or the very last scene for season one, and I have a big scene at an Italian family table. And there are about 8 or 9 actors at the table, and there's an entire crew in the room. And again, we had it catered, and we had all of a sudden there was a wardrobe department, and there was a makeup artist, and there was a hairstylist. Like, it was a whole big thing, and I had to leave the room. I had to leave the room and go off, and I had to cry for about 15 minutes because all of a sudden this thing that was so intimately and mine, all of a sudden belonged to everybody else.
Yeah.
And then it happened again in season two. I shot a scene, there's a wedding in season two, and we shot a scene and there were 26 actors in the room. And all of a sudden I realized what this thing had become and what this thing had grown into. And it was sort of shocking to me. And I don't know how I did it. I still to this day don't know how I did it, except I can just say that I kind of took it one step at a time. You know, okay, I need money. How do I get money? Okay, I need a crew. How do I find a crew? Okay, I need actors. How do I find actors? I need a location. Well, maybe I'll go into this restaurant and ask them. Or maybe I'll... Whatever, you know? And you just sort of figure it out. And a lot of it is awful. I mean, I love the show. Technically, there are some... You know, there are issues in the first season. And season two is better, technically. And although it has some issues as well, and season three will be better than season two, you know, you just sort of learn as you go.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a learning process. And, oh, and,
are we going to get our guest star here?
I don't know, we might. Okay. My director just walked into the room. So yeah, you just sort of figure it out. And the fact that, and it's been frustrating, and it's been, it's super tiring.
Yeah.
I'm exhausted all the time. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. But I am in love with the fact that it gets done.
Yeah. And
somehow.
And it's your baby.
Yeah. I mean, and again, people have come on, and, you know, all of a sudden it becomes a thing, and people want to be a part of it.
Yeah.
And people want to watch it, and people want to do things for you, which is kind of an amazing thing. And now I feel like we're in our stride. Now I feel like, you know, it has just sort of taken off. Again, it sort of has a life of its own. And, you know, and I see where it's going.
Yeah.
But partly I've kind of taken a little bit of a hands-off approach now.
I was going to ask you. Oh,
yeah.
Are you going to have that same, it's mine now, you're taking
it
away.
No, because now there are other people. Now there's a crew who I trust, and I have an editor now. Here's a perfect example of this. The first two seasons, I worked with a couple different editors, and I sat there every second watching every frame of it.
Yeah.
Okay, and to the editor, okay, cut here, do this, do that, do this, do that. And now, you know, I thought, you know what, I have a great editor this season, and I thought, you do it.
Wow.
You want to do it? Go do it. And he does it, and it finishes, and he calls me up and he says, hey, it's done, and he says, look at it, and I look at it and I say, it's great. So, you know,
life is better.
Yeah. So it's a it's something that I'm super, super, super proud of, and I have a great amount, as exhausting as it is, and as frustrating as it can be. It's also tremendously rewarding, and I'm thrilled with it, and I love it.
So, now that we've talked about the, you know, the character and, you know, the 45 hats that you wear and all
right,
that good stuff.
Right.
Let's get down to brass tacks. How do you pay for something like this? Because I think that's a fascinating story in itself for anybody who's listening who is interested in doing this or just has always wondered, you know, how do you make web series or TV show or anything like that?
Yeah, that's a great question, because again, it's one of those things that I did not know how to do. I knew I needed money because you have to pay people. And so my first season, I found out about crowdfunding, of course, which now everybody is doing. There's Kickstarter, there's Indiegogo, now there's a thing called GoFundMe, whatever. And so I used Indiegogo, and I just, I bombarded my Facebook and my Twitter and my email, list, with stuff about this Indiegogo campaign, and I was able to raise all the money that I needed for season one. And so we just did it. And then...
And if anybody is listening here and you can't hear it, we have this huge cappuccino machine that's going nuts in the background for the last 5 minutes. So we apologize.
No, we're trying to talk. I'm trying to talk really loud.
Yeah. But for season two.
Yeah. Well, so then I realized that... you know, you can only do that so many times. You can
right.
only ask. You can only ask your friends and your family. You know, so many times for money. And so I tried to figure out how to get investors and corporate, you know, corporations to give me money. Figured out again, it's one of those things. You just sort of you ask questions. I ask a lot of questions. I'm not afraid to appear dumb because seriously, I don't know what I'm doing still. So I ask people, how do you get corporations to give you money? Well, you put together a corporate sponsorship package. Okay, you know, so you have to offer them something. There has to be some kind of incentives. Okay, so what is that? And you just sort of go through this process. So that's what I ended up doing. I ended up figuring out how to. I mean, again, I'm an actor, so I barely went to school. You know, I mean, I barely read English. So.
Now, without giving away the name of the sponsor
yes.
that you
yeah,
ended
yeah.
up getting,
yes.
can you kind of tell me the story about how you approached it and then...
I came up with this idea, because my show is called Child of the 70s, I came up with this idea, I wanted to do something unique. I came up with this idea to find companies that existed in the 70s, like, for instance, Coca-Cola, Burger King, McDonald's, Pepsi, Dr. Pepper, Mattel, whatever, and get those companies... to advertise on my show. Companies that existed in the 70s and still exist today, to actually advertise on my show, to actually show commercials on my show, like selling airtime, just like a television series, but show old vintage commercials from the 70s. That was the idea that I had. And so that's what I put in the package, and I sent it out to all these different companies and got some bites and ended up getting sponsorship for, you know, for season three. Plus you can always find investors as well, you know, just, you know, private investors, people who, again, who see it and want to be a part of it. Hey, how can I help?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of stuff. People are out there who want to do this kind of stuff.
Would you say it's as easy or, well, I'll just ask the question, what's easier to get, a corporate sponsorship or some, you know, fantastic investor with deep pockets?
Yeah, you know what, to answer that question, I would say neither or both.
Okay.
I mean, it really sort of depends. None of it has been easy,
right?
I would say, but all of it is doable. Is that
well, you're also persistent, though. You're not
persistent.
Yeah.
No, I refuse to give up for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah.
And there, we've had a big time gap between season two and season three because it took me a long time to find this money. You know, which was a bummer, but that's okay. But I fully believe in not quitting.
Yeah.
So I had this idea, and I wanted to do it, and I wanted to see it through. I know where it's going. I know what season three is going to be. I know what season four is going to be. I know what season five is going to be. I know how I want it to end. And so giving up is just sort of not an option. So you just, again, and if that's the case, if you know where you're going to end up, then the trick is just figuring out how to get there.
Right.
You know, and inevitably, if you keep trying, you figure it out.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I think.
So who are some of the fantastic people that you have on the show?
My gosh, we have so many fantastic people. Of course, because it's the 70s, I wanted to work with all my childhood idols. In the first season, we had Donna Peskin.
From Saturday Night Fever
and Angie.
Angie, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And she plays my mother in season one. And then, my gosh, we have Susan Olsen.
yeah.
who is Cindy Brady.
Cindy Brady, yeah.
And we have Bruce Valanche, who's
yeah.
one of the funniest guys
ever.
Bruce Valanche is a comedian
yeah.
and writer.
Who doesn't know who Bruce is?
Well, I'm
know.
Hoping everybody knows
everybody
who Bruce Valanche is.
He's
in Hairspray on Broadway.
Yeah.
And
he's on Hollywood Squares.
He was on the Hollywood
he's,
Squares.
He's written
for a long
the
time.
Award shows for a million
for
years.
For years and years and years.
Yeah.
He was the head writer, I think, for the Oscars and the Tonys
yeah.
and the Emmys and all of that stuff. I first became aware of him, again, in the 70s because he wrote all of Bette Midler's material.
Oh, I didn't
know. I'm in love with Bette Midler. So he's on it. And Jerry Jewell is on
oh,
it.
Oh, Jerry Jewell.
Jerry Jewell from
yeah.
The Facts of Life.
Yeah.
And
she is hysterical in this, too.
She's great. And she actually, because my character moves to Los Angeles, I wanted to have some celebrity play themselves.
Yeah.
And I found her, and she said yes, and she was great fun to work with. And she is super great about making fun of herself.
Mm-hmm.
I love people who have a sense of humor about themselves. And to give you an example of how great her sense of humor is about herself, for those of you who have not seen the show, the first thing that happens to my character when I come to Los Angeles is I have a car accident. And who's driving the car? Jerry Jewell. Jerry Jewell has cerebral palsy. And she gets out of the car, and, you know, she has difficulty walking, you know. And so I of course, think that, oh, my God, I've paralyzed this poor woman, not realizing who she is. And she sort of went along with it and was really great about it. We have Sheena Metal. Sheena Metal is an L.A. Radio institution. She's been on the radio forever. Who else do we have? We have this great woman named Carolita White. Carolita White played Big Rosie on Laverne and Shirley back in the 70s. And I happened to meet her, and I thought, oh, my God, you're Big Rosie. And I said, will you be on my show? And she said, yes,
sure.
We're hoping to, I shouldn't say who.
Yeah,
we're hoping to get a few other 70s celebrities on season 3. But
so if you are a 70s celebrity,
yeah, call me.
Call
that's right, that's
Michael.
Right. Joyce DeWitt, call me.
There we go. Not, you know, we're not mentioning any names, Joyce DeWitt, but, you know, there we go. There we go.
That's right. Because I'm always looking for mothers. You know,
yeah.
We talked about this. One of the things that I love about 70s TV is when they replace actors, when they replace characters with different actors, and without any explanation
mm-hmm.
whatsoever.
Well,
the classic one is Bewitched.
Bewitched.
Of
yep.
course. They also did it on Roseanne.
Yep.
And
Dynasty.
Dynasty, of course.
Yeah, of course.
Absolutely, Steven. That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Right. That's right. Oh, Dallas did it too, you know. Dallas,
oh, yeah.
Barbara Bel Geddes
yeah,
played the mother,
right,
and then all of a sudden
right.
it's Donna Reed.
Yeah, for a season.
And so I love that stuff. So we came up with this great idea to have my mother played by a different actress every year.
Yeah.
Season 2, we had this amazing actress named Lynn Marie Stewart, who is famous for playing Miss Yvonne on Pee-wee's Playhouse. She played my mother season 2. We have a surprise special guest playing my mother in season 3. I can't say who it is yet. But yeah, so every year we're gonna have we have a different mother, and we never say anything about it.
Which is the best, because, and I'm not gonna give it away, but when Mom and Carlo reunite in season 2,
yes.
there is a line that is spoken that just I was glad that I wasn't out in public, because I would have needed to be wearing the pins. I would have peed my pants.
Oh, well, that's very nice.
And because, you know, you just get so invested in the show, and then all of a sudden that line comes out, and you're like, he didn't just say that. And it was great. It was so classic. So, yeah, you have to watch. So, where do people see your show, by the way? We've talked about it now.
Yeah, you can find us on YouTube. It's youtube.com/childofthe70s. We also have our own website, the official childofthe70s.com. We're also on Funny or Die. We are. If you look online, there's an online channel called Gay Direct. You can find us there. You can find us on blip.tv. We're tons of places. We're on many, many, many different platforms. So all you have to do is go to Google and type in Childhood 70s, and you'll find us.
Totally fine.
We have 2 seasons. We have 5 episodes in season 1, and we have 7 episodes in season 2, so 12 altogether.
12 altogether. So any last words of wisdom for budding screenwriters or actors or people in entertainment, given your vast experiences?
Yeah, okay. I feel like I'm a really perfect, because I've been doing this again since I am since a child, since I was 8 years old.
Yeah.
Got my first job. Got into SAG, I think, when I was 10 or 12, something like that. And like you said, we were talking before, persistence. I feel like, you know, it's a hard life. And so I feel like if you're not, if you can do anything else and be happy, then I would do it. You know, my experience was that I couldn't do anything else. I was just compelled to do this, and nothing else would make me happy. And so I just kept at it. And that's it. I just think persistence. I think just don't ever give up. Because I always feel like this. I heard this once, and it has stayed with me for the rest of my life. Maybe it's fear. I don't know. But the day you give up is the day before, like, the miracle happens.
Right.
And so I thought, my God, if I quit today, I will live the rest of my life afraid that if I had just lasted one more day, everything would have changed.
Right.
You know, did you watch the SAG Awards the other night?
I was...
The SAG Awards were on the other night, and there was a woman who won a SAG Award for the show Orange is the New Black.
Right.
And one of the things that she said on the show, which made me cry, she said the day she got that job, she was literally, like, the next day going to quit show business.
Oh, my God.
She said she had had it, like, she had gone to
her. She's done.
She was done.
Yeah, yeah.
She was like, I can't do this anymore. Like, and that day, you know, she got that job, and it changed her life, and she won a SAG Award. So, that would be my advice, I guess, if I was going to, you know, as hard as it is and as tough as it is, just find support for yourself with friends and family and whatever. Just don't ever, ever, ever give up, ever.
So the last thing I'm going to have you talk about before we end your segment here on the show, you surprised me when I met you for lunch a couple of weeks ago. You brought me two very fantastic presents. And, you know, I guess it's one of those things that, you know, I should not be surprised. You know, writer, director, producer, actor, you know, vampire, witch, werewolf.
Yes.
You know, all of the...
Right.
You're also a singer.
Yeah.
And so you brought me two CDs that you've worked on in the past, and we're going to be playing some of your music as we wrap up the hour today. And as we're sitting here, I don't know which songs we're going to be playing, so it'll be a mystery, because I'll be pressing a button right when we're doing the show live.
All right, okay.
But tell me about the two CDs real quick.
The first one is called Archangel, and that is a company called Original Cast Records in New York City. They came to me and asked me if I wanted to do a CD. I was a cabaret singer. They had seen my cabaret act, and I said, yeah, I would love to do a CD, but I don't want to. But everything they had done before was like either original Broadway cast recordings, or they had done like cabaret type dish CDs, albums. And I said I wasn't really interested in doing that. I wanted to do like a pop album, and they said okay. And so we sort of created this. It has a very 70s feel to it, of course. There are a few covers, 70s covers on it, but even all the originals sort of have that sort of 70s bubblegum
feel
to them, which is just the kind of music that I adore.
Yeah.
You know, growing up with the Partridge Family and Bobby Sherman and all that, whatever. And so I wanted to create something like that, and we did, and I love it. So that's called Archangel, and I'm naked on the cover, which is awesome. And then...
if you got it, flaunt it, you know.
Well, you know, well, because I figured, I remember thinking, like, nobody knows who I am. Nobody's going to buy this thing. And they were like, well, let's put you naked on the cover. Maybe somebody will buy it, you know, if you show your ass. And I was like, okay, great, let's do it. I'm all for it.
Let's make a buck, right?
And I did.
Yeah.
People bought it just because of that picture. And then the second one is called Wait for Him, which is a very different album.
Yeah.
It's very ballad heavy. It's dedicated to I was married for a while, and I had a husband named Antonio who unfortunately passed away in 2009. So I did this CD to honor him and dedicated it to him. And it sort of tells the story of our relationship, you know, from when we met and then we got married and then we lost him. And so that's a very different experience too. And it's lovely and I love it, you know.
Do you have any plans to sing in the future?
Yeah. Well, I'm definitely going to... We're going to do a Child of the 70s CD. We're going to do music from the show or, you know, songs inspired by the show, that type of thing. So that should happen within the next couple of years for sure.
Very cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Awesome. Well, everybody, it's been Michael Beccaro. He's the star of everything having to do with Child of the 70s. So go out and watch it on YouTube, and we'll be right back after this.
cool experience to be able to do that interview with Michael earlier, airing it today, and getting a chance to actually re-listen to it. So it was kind of fun for me to sit back and listen to this while we're doing this, while we're doing it live here anyway. But that was Michael's version of Making It, that popular hit from the late 70s, early 80s. That was always fun to listen to. We've got a couple more. I think we're going to have time for one more tonight. I may have to bring Michael back on as a Friday Night Dance Party special guest star one of these Fridays. But in the meantime, here is a quick preview for the rest of the week. On Tuesday, we've got Ian Verdun with Life's a Drag. It's a new web series that's out. He's going to be on the show talking about that. Wednesday, we've got Greg Archer, the king of pop culture roulette. He is coming on to talk about his memoir, Grace Revealed. And then Thursday, we have got a really cool guest. I say she's a really cool guest because I got a really cool book. It's Lisa S. Johnson, and she's the author of 108 Rockstar Guitars. And she was a big sponsor at NAMM this year, and I can't wait to talk to her. I have the book. Their press people sent that to me. The book is huge, and the soft copy, you know, not the hardback, the soft copy was $40. The hardback is $450 or something like this. So it's a high-end art coffee table book, which you will freak out when you take a look at it. So if you've got a guitar lover or music lover in your life, this is a book I think you'll want to have in your collection. And Friday we're going back to EDM, electronic dance music, with episodes of the Twix Mix, thanks to DJ Justin Case. So that's coming to you on Friday. I can't wait to do it all with you. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, want to have a guest on, or know somebody who's really fascinating, contact me here at Rated G Radio on Facebook. You can find me or send me an email at garrett@garrettmiller.com, and it would be a pleasure to have them on. Here's one more by Michael Vaccaro, and we'll see you live on Tuesday.
You are the dancing queen, young and sweet, only seven. You've been listening to Rated G Radio.